Welcome to another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast, a production of the Criminal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School in Charlottesville, Virginia. Every 2 weeks, we release a new episode. Today, we're going to have a conversation about a recent opinion from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Please note that these episodes may contain facts and circumstances surrounding criminal trials. Listener discretion is advised.
Rise! Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America at this moment.
Welcome to another episode of Criminal Law Presents Podcasts. My name is Major James Barrett, and today, for those of you listening, we have a record-setting podcast for everybody. We have a total of 6 people on this podcast today. Joining us is a bunch of juggernauts in the Criminal Law Department, and we also have Dustin Morgan joining us. Today, we've got J.P. Turner, Major from the United States Marine Corps, active duty. We also have Major Annie Freebie, active duty Air Force. We also have Captain Coral Pagan joining us from the Army Reserves. We also have first-time podcaster here, Joe Mormon from the Criminal Law Department, and as previously said, we have Dustin Morgan. We'd like today to talk to you about United States v. Warda, 2023 CAF Lexus 687, a case revolving around the abatement of the proceedings for evidence that was not available. Major Turner, want to go ahead and start us off with some basic facts of how we got here?
Yes. So there, both the factual background and the procedural background are important. So the basic facts on Sergeant Warda, he was accused. He met the victim, MB, on Facebook in 2012. MB is not a U.S. citizen. She was a female living in the country of Jordan. So in 2015, he travels to Jordan, asks for permission to get married, and they get married in December of 2015. So he returns back to the U.S. and she stays in Jordan. Eventually, in May of 2017, she travels to New York and the U.S. to get her green card and to start living with Sergeant Warda. Of course, when she shows up, they start having marital troubles that pop up. Around September of 2017, Sergeant Warda decides to invoke talaq for the third time, which is the way that they kind of finalize their divorce or marriage. When this happened, MB told Sergeant Warda that she wanted citizenship and the dowry that she was promised. And Sergeant Warda pretty much told her that she wasn't going to get these things. And in response, MB told her, "You will see what I'm going to do and you will regret it." In October of 2017, she reported to civilian law enforcement that Sergeant Warda had forced her to have sex, including an incident in August of 2017, which was the background of the rape charge, which she was ultimately convicted of.
And when he was ultimately convicted, what was his, do you have a sentence handy?
I believe the sentence was 7 years of confinement, dishonorable discharge, and Russian E1.
Okay.
So, fast forward, in April 2018, the divorce is officially finalized. In May of 2019, MB's initial green card expires. However, she's still able to stay living in the United States. She gets a job working for a nonprofit that helps provide immigration services and is able to freely travel to and from Jordan back to the United States.
And this immigration issue, that becomes central part of this case, which is why we're here today, right?
That becomes the central part of the case. At trial, the government's main evidence was the testimony of MB. There were no eyewitnesses, no medical evidence, no law enforcement reports or testimony in evidence, or no forensic exams such as a sexual assault forensic exam. So the credibility of MB was a central issue of importance in the case.
And why did the defense counsel want her immigration records in this case?
Yep, so the defense counsel submitted a discovery request for MB's immigration status. They wanted that because it was key to their theory of the case, which is that her immigration status provided a motive to fabricate the offenses.
Okay, and so by alleging what she's alleged against Sergeant Warda, she's then benefited in the immigration system, and so the defense is now arguing that that's her biased motive to fabricate why she's bringing forth these allegations against him.
That's correct. Defense filed their first specific discovery request for the immigration status files, and then they followed it up with a supplemental request for the I-918 Supplement B certification. That is a certification that provides protections and benefits for immigrants who are the victim of domestic violence or sexual assault offenses.
Okay, and so the government ultimately subpoenas these records, right?
Yes.
The immigration system, they gleefully complied?
Nope. So a subpoena was sent to the Department of Homeland Security and USCIS. They denied the initial subpoena and say that they can only release those records with either the consent of the person involved or if it met a Privacy Act exception.
And in fact, they even went further and said, we're not even going to say these records exist. And even if they did exist, we're not going to comply with the subpoena, even if the military judge ordered us to.
Yep, that's correct.
Playing some hardball.
Yes. So that kind of ties into the procedural history of what happened from there. So after that initial denial, defense submitted a discovery request to have MB consent to the disclosure. She declined to do so. From there, defense filed a motion to dismiss the charges to prevent MB from testifying or to abate the proceedings until the requested documentation was provided.
And ultimately, the military judge denies all those motions. And what is the military judge's remedy in this case for the defense for not being able to have access to those records?
Yep. So the judge denies the motions, and he says that he will give substantial leeway on cross-examination of MB during trial.
Okay. And that did, in fact, happen?
Yeah, it did, in fact, happen. At trial, during direct examination, MB said, words to the effect of, if she did not marry Sergeant Warda, she would never have moved to the United States. At that point, defense raised a 914 Jinx Act motion for any statements of the witness in possession of the United States. Judge again denied that request from defense. So at trial, defense was able to ask questions on cross-examination. They asked variations of questions about whether there was any immigration rule that allows you to apply for a green card without your husband if you are the victim of abuse. MB kept kind of avoiding that question and saying, I'm not an expert, I don't know. So defense was kind of cut off from being able to get into that at trial, the trial level.
And we're in CAF now because Sergeant Warda actually was convicted.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. So, great rundown of the facts, Major Turner. Major Freebie, what was the framework that CAF looked at this problem with?
CAF reviews the military judge's failure to obey the proceedings by an abuse of discretion standard, which basically means that they found that the findings of facts are clearly erroneous, the court's decision is influenced by an erroneous view of the law, or the military judge's decision on the issue at hand is outside the range of choices reasonably arising from the applicable facts and law.
Great. Thank you. Major Moore, anything to add?
No, that's a good rundown.
Awesome. All right. Now, to talk about how we analyze this issue, we're going to go to our resident reservist, Captain Coral Pagan. Captain Pagan, what do you have for us?
So in the analysis section, CAF starts by talking about a moving party under RCM 703 must show that what is being requested actually exists. And although the trial judge here concluded that the appellant had failed to meet his burden, that the requested records existed, CAF disagreed. They stated that there was ample evidence that this A file, the alien file, of MB existed. And they cite, for example, that she had traveled to New York in May 2017 to get a green card, as Major Turner stated. Her green card had expired in May 2019. And by the time of trial, which was in September 2020, she had actually already gone to Jordan a couple times to visit her family, and she was a college student and employed in the U.S. So CAF decided that the trial judge's conclusion that the defense had failed to establish that documentation of MB's immigration status existed was actually outside the range of choices reasonably arising from the applicable laws in fact.
And not to interrupt you, but Major Mormon, I think it's kind of a lesson for the field here, right? A lot of broad terms being used. Do you have any comment on maybe how to avoid some of these similar issues?
Yes, I do. And before we kind of pivot to some recommendations for the field, I would just point out that one of the things that the appellate court took a look at here was the distinction between what the defense requested in the I-918 file and the distinction between the A file. And so the trial court kind of lumps these two files together, and when it goes through its analysis, pays particular attention to the fact that maybe the defense didn't establish that MB came into contact with immigration as a victim of domestic violence, which would be the I-918 file. But as it outlines in detail, there was ample evidence that there was an immigration file. And of critical importance here, the defense asked for both. And so that dovetails into a key practice point for the field, which is precision. Precision is key. We will loop back to this concept at the end of this podcast. But for both the government and the defense, whether you are arguing that a file is relevant and necessary and exists, or whether you are arguing that it is not relevant and necessary, or in the alternative, does not exist, we must use precise language at the trial level to indicate to the court what exactly we're looking for.
That's great. Thank you very much, Major Morgan. All right, Captain Bugan, you may continue.
Yes. So next, CAFS talks about central importance. A party seeking relief under RCM 703 Foxtrot 2 must show that the unavailable evidence is essential to a fair trial. So the government's case here rises and falls completely on MB's credibility. And as Major Turner previously stated, it's important that here there were no eyewitnesses, there was no medical evidence, there was no law enforcement report or testimony admitted into evidence, and no forensic evidence. So MB's credibility is of central importance in this case. Basically, the conclusion for central importance here from CAF was that defense had established that the evidence concerning MB's immigration status was of central importance to her credibility.
It's important to also remember in this case, we're not arguing whether this would have been successful or not. We're simply arguing that the absence of the ability to look at this evidence was so central to the trial and how it progressed that the military judge should have, at the trial level, made it the proceedings.
Absolutely, sir. And specifically, Cass states that her immigration status is the central tenet of the defense theme in this case.
Yes. And it's also important to note, as Major Turner pointed out in the facts, that the immigration services said that they were never going to comply with this. And you see how CAF loops that in at the very end when they hold what, Captain Gunn?
First, sir, they talk about the adequate substitute. So they say that the substantial leeway on cross-examination was not an adequate substitute to remedy the fact that they did not have these immigration records for the defense. So the remedy would have been to abate the proceedings.
Correct, because this evidence would have never been produced, or at least within a reasonable amount of time.
Yes, sir.
Okay. That was a great rundown. Before I get to you, Major Mormon, I'm going to go over to Major Morgan. Major Morgan, one justice dissented in this case. Can you talk about what their disagreement with the majority was?
Yeah, so before we get there, I think it's important to talk about where we are. So we're in the rules for court-martial, right? We're not in the rules of evidence. We're not in the actual statute itself. So these are the rules by which you play the game when it comes to establishing a court-martial from start to end. So when we talk about RCM 703, why Major Mormon is here, because it's his area of expertise. We're in discovery. So in 703, this is evidence that's not typically within the control of the prosecutor, within the control of the government, that they have to go out and seek. And you saw that here through the ordering of the subpoena and through the ordering of the court order, and ultimately Immigration Services not complying with that. So a unique kind of aspect for those that don't practice military justice regularly. Our defense counsel don't have subpoena power. They don't have the ability to go out and get records on their own. They're entirely dependent on the government. And their failure to do so here is why we're talking about an abatement. So Judge Maggs, in writing the dissent, disagrees with that last assertion that Captain Pagan just talked about, the central importance to the case. So basically, was cross-examination a good enough substitute for these immigration records? And Judge Maggs goes through, in pretty big detail, the four questions in particular that he thought were impactful on the cross-examination. And basically, in his eyes, what the trial practitioners were able to do, what the defense counsel was able to do, was show that there may have been another reason for her not wanting the government to have these records. They were able to ferret out that bias, ferret out things that would call into question her credibility when determining whether or not she was being truthful to the fact finder, which is ultimately, as Captain McGon said, that the ultimate goal of the defense counsel, because all you have is her testimony as the government. So he says the cross-examination was sufficient, it was an adequate substitute, because they failed to meet that prong, the judge did not abuse his discretion. And that's important here. It's not that he's saying that was in and of itself adequate. He's saying the judge did not abuse his discretion in reaching that ultimate determination.
And that plays perfectly into the final discussion here is the tips for the field here, and that's why I think we can all agree that the remedy in this case is pretty drastic. You don't see it too often. This is the one in the 100 cases where you see something truly get abated under 703F, under the rules for court-martial. And if you're a defense counsel or if you're government counsel fighting against it, particularly from the defense side, is you have to be precise. You have to tell the judge why this has such a material effect on your case. And that may cause you to have to articulate to the judge cross-examination, how the fact finder may perceive the answers to that cross-examination, and why those relate to either the elements of the offense, a defense to the offense, and then potentially, ultimately, it was crucial in this case, the credibility of a witness. And if you don't articulate that appropriately, judges are going to rule for you, one, and two, your defense appellate counsel is going to be hamstrung as they try to fight that judge's ruling when couldn't put on the record or articulate your basis for all of that. And Major Mormon, do you have something to add to some other practice tips? I know we talked about being precise, using precise language, but any final tips from the field on this?
Yeah, before we move off of precision with facts, I just want to dovetail back to that concept. And I would be remiss if I did not mention that none of us here were at the trial level, so we are limited to our review of the appellate record. That being said, based on what we've read...
And you're making my point for me with that comment.
Exactly. So with precision, and Warda in particular, I would like to point out that the court, a number of times throughout its opinion, makes reference to the fact that the government conceded relevance and necessity. Now, I'm not here to tell you whether they should or should not have done that. I think a reasonable person reviewing this opinion would arrive to the same conclusion. But what I would point out is that the government conceded relevance to broad request for immigration files generally. So whether or not that was a good strategic decision or whether or not that was lawful, the practice point is that we should be very, very precise in what we're agreeing is relevant and necessary or what we're asking for if we're the defense. And so that drove a significant portion of the court's analysis because rather than perhaps a review over what was and was not relevant and necessary, we had an agreement between the parties at the trial level for a very broad cross-section of documents, potentially. So that dovetails back to our precision language regarding the facts. Now, regarding the rules, as we can see from the appellate opinion, there was some misunderstanding between the applicability of RCM 701 and RCM 703.
That's a great point, Major Moore.
And even at the trial level, the judge conflated his ruling when discussing whether or not the defense met their burden between those rules. And the court very quickly pointed out, without giving an opinion on the ruling as it relates to RCM 701, the court simply pointed out that the judge at the trial level failed to issue findings of fact and conclusions of law with respect to RCM 703. So this brings us back to our point. We've got to be precise as trial practitioners, not only with our application of the facts, but also as they relate to the various rules that are implicated.
Awesome. Thank you. That concludes our analysis of United States v. Warda. But before we go, just a little bit from our guest hosts. This is kind of why they're here at the grad course. A lot of people think that the grad course here at the TJAGLIX is only for Army personnel, but as you can tell, active duty Army personnel. But as you can tell, if you were here looking around the table, you would see that's not true. Major J.P. Turner, go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, how you ended up here.
Yep. So I come from a long history of judge advocates. So my dad was a JAG for the Navy, graduated Naval Justice School back in 1989, so kind of runs in the family. I decided to join the Marine Corps and one up my dad by joining the Marine Corps, not the Navy. In 2016, from there, I was a trial counsel out at Marine Corps Base Hawaii and then assistant senior defense counsel at Marine Corps Base Camp Pendleton. For the Marines, we go on a screening board, and a few of us are selected to come to the grad course every year. I was lucky enough to be selected and go through the grad course, and it's been an amazing time so far.
And the Marines, they send you here for a specific specialty, correct?
Yep, so we have a different specialty. So we have a 4409, which is the military justice specialty. There's also a 4405 for operational law and a 4417 for cyber law. I'm on the military justice track.
Awesome. Well, thank you for being here. It's awesome to have you. Major Freebie, you're at the Air Force. How'd you end up here at the Army school?
It seemed like a good idea. I joined the Air Force in 2017. Our assignments are a little different than the Army in that we are expected to be jacks of all trades in our first assignment. One of the things I got to do at my first assignment was be trial counsel. So I was trial counsel at Anderson Air Force Base, Guam. And then I was a chief of justice at Peterson, then Air Force Base, now Space Force Base. And then I was a defense counsel at Barksdale. And while there, I applied to the grad course and was accepted. And now I'm specializing in military justice.
Awesome. Thank you. Have you enjoyed it so far?
Yes.
Is the Army what all of you expected?
It's better.
We'll take it. And then we have a reservist here, Captain Coral Pagan. A lot of people think this is merely for active duty. Major Turner, Major Freebie are both active duty. You're a reservist. What was your path to the grad course here?
Yes, sir. So in 2017, I actually joined the JAG Corps on active duty. During my time on active duty, I was 2 years in Korea, 2 years in Germany, and 1 year in Honduras. I got out and decided to go back to live in Puerto Rico as a reservist, but always had the grad course in my mind because I always wanted to do it. And a couple of years ago, they actually opened up 2 slots in the grad course here for 2 reservists to come attend. And this year, unfortunately, they had funding only for 1, but fortunately, I was able to be here. As a reservist, just so you know, there is a Judge Advocate Officer Advanced course. That is the equivalent of the grad course, but for the reservist. And it has 2 phases, 1 phase, which is completely online, and then the 2nd phase, which you come here in December for 2 weeks, and that is considered that you're educationally qualified to move from the rank of captain to major. And that's how I'm here, sir. And I have very much enjoyed my time here at the grad course, and I'm super happy to be here, sir.
Awesome. Well, it's been fun to have everybody. Major Mormon, thank you for your first podcast. We'll get you out here. And for those of you listening out of the airwaves, we always thank you for listening. Go ahead and email us with any comments or suggestions. But with that, we'll wrap this one up. So thank you very much, and everybody have a great day.
Thanks for joining us today for another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast. If anything you heard sparked a thought, we'd love to connect with you. Your comments help us create better future content for the field or the fleet. Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram. The information can be found in the show notes for today's episode. The views expressed in today's podcast are those of the presenters and not necessarily the Judge Advocate General's Corps, the Department of the Army, or the Department of Defense.
Thanks, counsel, for both sides. And the court will stand in recess until further order of the court.